The Heaven Field, a novel by I.G. Hume, read by the author. Episode 6, Out of Time. Okay, your attention please, everybody. Grace waited impatiently for the hubbub to subside. Thank you. Now, all of you will have varying amounts of information as to what is going on, so for the benefit of all, I'll try and go through most things from the beginning. Most of you will have come from the refitting work at Hyden Hill, so you'll probably know me already, though it has been a while since I worked there. Some of you may know why. She paused and gave a wry smile. There were a couple of titters from a group sitting around one of the tables near the front of the low conference room, and somebody called out, "Smoke one for me, Grace," to the amusement of those nearby. "Yes, thank you, Paul. Nice to see you too. Anyway, my name is Grace Palmer, and I am head of research here. Now, some of you are familiar with the workings of this facility, and have been brought in to give your immediate assistance. Others," she shot a glance towards Thomas, who sat alone and embarrassed at the back of the room. "Others amongst you have been brought in for more incomprehensible reasons, and we'll just have to make sure you don't get in the way for the time being, until we have a chance to find a job for you." A ripple of nervous laughter ran through the room. Thomas turned crimson again, and wished the ground would swallow him up. He still didn't have the faintest idea what he was doing here, and worse still, nobody else seemed to know either. Grace had barely said two words to him in the short journey from the concourse to the conference room. "Sit at the back and grab a coffee," she had said to him, "and don't pester anybody." Thomas, who felt awkward enough amongst his few close friends, now longed to wake up from this horrible nightmare, and find himself once more mercifully alone in his familiar, cluttered bedroom. "As you know," Grace was now continuing, "the accident at Hyden Hill put the chamber out of action for the foreseeable future, if not indefinitely." A concerned murmur ran through her audience. Grace took a deep breath. "I say that because it seems that several incidents have occurred which may jeopardise the entire project." Grace paused for the chatter of anxious voices to die down. "Now, some of you will be aware that this complex, Maundsworth, is a sister facility to Hyden Hill. What you probably don't know is that it is a duplicate of Hyden, and up until now has had a fully operational accelerator array of its own." A flutter of astonishment ran around the room. "Have you tried it fully? Does it work?" A cacophony of questions rang out from the excited gathering of scientists, technicians, and engineers. Grace held up her hand and waited for the noise to subside. "The short answer is, yes, we've tried it. We have successfully created the field in a sustained and controllable manner. And yes," she paused with a smile on her lips, "yes, we have travelled through it." There was uproar in the conference room. People stood and besieged Grace with astonished questions, their excitement now unleashed and unstoppable. Thomas felt as if he sat in the eye of a storm. He tried to take in what was being said, but could grasp no point of reference. He knew more than most about Standing Point, but surely all this stuff was still just theoretical. The amounts of energy needed, the vast scale of an accelerator array. And what did she mean, "we've travelled through it"? Thomas's mind performed somersaults, his imagination given freedom by these new possibilities. In the meantime, Grace had managed to regain some sort of order, though the excitement in the air was still tangible. "Please, please, everyone. I realise how intriguing all this must be, but I promise you will have every opportunity to find out more at a later date. Now, as I said, Maundsworth has been fully functional for several weeks now, and all the experiments have met with continuous success. But today, during an expedition headed by Saul Davison, an explosion occurred here, preventing us from returning some of the team. The body of one member was recovered." She drifted off for a second, her eyes downcast. "But we must assume that the others are still alive and can be brought back safely." A small, round-faced and red-bearded man rose from his seat. "May I ask the name of the one you recovered?"
"Patty."
"Oh, Patricia Harvey," whispered Grace almost to herself. "I don't think you knew her, Jim. I brought her in from an archaeological project." "Who else is on the team, besides Davison?" asked Jim, cleaning his spectacles on the end of his tie. Beside Saul, there's Gary Starling, who you know, and two technicians, Stuart Nix and Dan O'Keefe. She pronounced the name slowly and morosely. "So was this explosion an accident or sabotage?" asked a young woman in brown cords and a white blouse. "There seemed to be a lot of rumours flying around." Grace paused for a moment, and then snapped back into her former mood. "We are not sure yet," she lied badly. "But just in case, security has been stepped up considerably. So please be considerate towards our military friends and all their new time-consuming checks." Now, thankfully, there were no fatalities in the explosion, but there were several casualties whose places you are all here to fill. Like I said before, this facility is pretty much a duplicate of Haydn, so you shouldn't have any trouble fitting in. Work will be finished on the array sublinking system, where the explosion occurred, in the next hour at most. It will take around another hour to run through the setup and prepare the chamber. Now, the team has been out in the field for just over 14 hours. They each carry 8-hour tanks, and a replacement for each member is stored at base camp. Now, with the one extra tank between them, they should have about 2 hours spare by the time we get to them. So, if we all work well and to schedule, we can bring them back safely and with no worries. Okay? Grace spoke as if she were reassuring herself as much as she was the others. There was a heavy silence throughout the conference room. Everyone except Thomas was digesting the magnitude of what Grace had told them, ready to go to work and do their jobs. Jim, the round-faced scientist, stood once again.
Grace, with no disrespect intended, these people you have gathered here are mainly systems technicians and engineers, am I not correct?
That's right, Jim. What's your point? Asked Grace, looking up from some notes.
Well, if we're all replacements for injured personnel, that's fine. But as you are well aware, I'm the new Director of Control Systems at Haydn Hill, said Jim calmly.
And? Asked Grace.
Well, surely that's your job here. Why do you need me?
He tugged at his collar. He was sweating in the stuffy room. I'll be leading the rescue mission, said Grace matter-of-factly. I'll need you to oversee and coordinate the mission. Jim slumped back in his chair as if he had been struck. He looked visibly paler.
But Grace, I can't just walk in and direct something of this magnitude. I'll need time to run through.
You've done it hundreds of times before in similar situations, interjected Grace. There was a desperate look in her eyes.
I trust you to do this, Jim. There's nobody else more qualified.
She looked away sadly. Jim gave a deep sigh as if he was steeling himself for the hours ahead.
Very well, then. I'll need reports and all data from the previous experiments. A full resume of staff.
It's all in your office, broke in Grace. Jim lifted an eyebrow.
My office?
He asked. You're in charge now, Jim. Sorry, said Grace with a half-smile. I've got my own set of problems to prepare for. Jim stood up and walked over to Grace, placing his hand gently on her shoulder. He smiled at her for a moment, then his eyes lit up and he turned to address the room.
Okay, everybody. I want you all to report to your usual stations and get a briefing from your team leaders. You know the drill. Then I want all of you back here in 30 minutes, and you can tell me any problems you think you have. Not that I want to hear any, of course.
He was an excellent team leader, Jim Grayson. Highly animated, always warm and approachable. He was like some good-natured uncle. He'll get the best out of them, thought Grace to herself.
So, where's my office today? Asked Jim with a smile.
Oh, I think they put you down in... Oh, Neil. Neil, can you show Jim to his new office, please?
Thanks.
She stood up as Jim turned to leave with the white-coated youth who stood near the open doorway. All the people from the conference were filing out now, in a babble of excited conversation.
Thank you, Jim. I knew I could rely on you, said Grace. You must have had one hell of a day, Grace, said Jim gently. But don't worry. They'll be all right.
And with that, he was gone, his cheerful voice receding into the distance as he called out greetings to passing co-workers. Only Grace and Thomas remained in the room. He stood up nervously and approached her.
Excuse me,
he stammered nervously, breaking her reverie.
Oh, Timothy, yes. Now, what are we going to do with you? Sighed Grace.
She fumbled around for a cigarette.
I'd be glad to help, If there's anything I can do, I mean, he squeaked.
Grace gave a deep sigh and looked him up and down.
Yes, you know, I think there is something, she said with a wry smile.
Find yourself a pen and paper and go down to systems control. Make a list. Thomas nodded seriously and fumbled for a biro.
I'll have a cheese salad on brown with no onions and a black coffee, 3 sugars, okay?
Someone in control will point you to the canteen. Then she was gone, leaving Thomas staring open-mouthed in the centre of the empty conference room.
Starling cursed and threw the pieces of corroded wire back into the jumble of components in front of him.
Oh, it's no good, he said wearily. There just isn't enough here that works.
They had just spent the past hour cannibalizing every available spare part on their suits in an attempt to make a working tracker system.
We don't even know if the base camp transmitter will still be working, sighed Nix.
So what are our options? Asked Davison gravely.
Well, the transmitter beacons in our suits still appear to be functioning, said Starling. So the rescue team should still be able to find us, though I don't know how long they're going to last. We could try taking one apart and see if there are any components we can use to fix the tracker.
No, I don't like it, said Saul. Those are our last chances of being found in this storm.
Assuming a team comes to look for us, said Nix.
They may be sending beacons now and we're just not picking up the signal.
No, I think they're bound to send a team eventually. But I think you're right about the beacons, too. There's a good chance that they're sending them, and we don't know about it.
Gary, how much air do we have left?
1 hour 35 on mine, said Starling, brushing the dust off the gauge.
Okay, said Saul. Well, I think we should try and get back to base camp. If they are sending beacons, then we can get straight out. And if not, well, then the rescue team won't have to search for us.
There was a long silence.
I'm not going back to the camp.
Not while that thing's still there, whispered Dan O'Keefe from where he sat in the corner.
Then you'll die in about 2 hours, idiot, snapped Nix.
All right, Stuart, warned Saul.
Look, Dan, it's gone, okay? The creature's gone. You know that. Now we need to get back to the camp. There'll be either a beacon or a rescue team, and we'll go home. That's the only choice we've got.
That's assuming we can find our way back in a zero-visibility sandstorm, said Starling.
I don't know, Saul. Maybe we should just sit tight here. We could go off in the wrong direction and end up further away from the camp.
We can make it, said Davison desperately.
It's roughly straight off from the gully as we go out of the cave.
Oh, come on, Saul. It took us half an hour to find the camp when we still had the trackers, snapped Starling.
I'm not going back there, sobbed O'Keefe.
Will you shut the fuck up, you fucking coward? We're trying to get you back home here, shouted Nix.
Hey, just calm right down, Nix, yelled Davison.
Well, I'm sick of that miserable fuck. We got no choice, he screamed at O'Keefe.
There was a painful silence for several seconds. Saul took a deep breath and stood up.
Nix is right. We have no choice. If we don't go now, we won't have enough air to get back to the camp.
Starling looked up at him bleakly and whispered with a tone of resignation.
We're going to use more air walking than sitting.
We'll have to get back at some point, Gary, sighed Saul.
But a rescue team will bring spare tanks.
I'm not going to sit here and suffocate to death, said Saul quietly. Now come on, we're going.
They stood up and shuffled to the mouth of the cave. Davison led O'Keefe gently by the arm. He put up no resistance, following him in a daze. They emerged from the cave back into the howling storm. Davison stumbled as he was hit by a gust of wind.
Okay then, everybody keep close, he shouted over the gale.
They set off down the gully. Davison stared ahead, trying to find any familiar landmarks, but he didn't recognize anything at all. There was a strange feeling around him, and he stopped and shook his head a few times, wiping the dust from his visor. He thought he glimpsed shadows beyond the dust clouds, but when he peered harder, they just seemed to melt away. They came to the bottom of the gully, and Davison looked for the tall spike of rock he had noticed the previous times they had been past. There was no sign of it anymore. It was as if the shape of the land had changed. He looked around with growing anxiety.
"Do you think we should turn back?"
asked Starling quietly. He had a similar worried look on his own face.
"We've got to go on," Davison pleaded. "We must go on."
He turned and stumbled off into the howling storm.
"Hello, security?" "Yes." "What was that? Say again, I can't hear you."
Grace swore again into the intercom. A burst of static filled the air of the control room, and then they could make out the voice of Adams, the security team leader.
"I said we have zero team members. The chamber is empty."
"Fuck,"
cursed Grace to herself.
"Where can they be?"
She paced the floor of the control room, biting her fingernails.
"It's only the first beacon," comforted Jim Grayson. "Chances are they won't have had time to get to the doorway. I'm sure they will be waiting for the next one. Now shouldn't you be suiting up, Grace?"
"I just wanted to see the first beacon go," muttered Grace.
"You were right, Jim. 5 minutes was too short a time. Do you think the next one should..."
"Grace," said Jim calmly. He took off his spectacles and polished them on his tie. With his eyes screwed up, he looked like a mole.
"Grace, we needed to send that beacon to test the system as much as anything else. You know that. Now, we'll be able to send the next beacon in about 15 minutes. If there's still no sign of them, then you're going to have to be ready to go in."
Grace nodded nervously to herself.
"You're right as ever, Jim. I'm going. "Are you sure about going through with this?"
asked Jim quietly, as she turned to go.
"What do you mean?"
asked Grace, fumbling with a pile of notes.
"Are you sure that you're up to leading the rescue?" he asked calmly.
Grace stopped what she was doing and looked shocked. She stared into space for a moment and then looked back at Jim.
"There's no one else more qualified, Jim. I'll bring them back."
"I know you will," said Jim tenderly. "Good luck, Grace."
Grace stood alone in the small lift, staring out over the vast structure of the array. The large glass walls gave her a spectacular view of the huge convergence of pipes and gantries, which ended up in the chamber. Although the lift descended rapidly, it still took several minutes to get from control to level one and the entrance to the chamber. She walked through the brightly lit corridors towards the changing rooms, passing nervous-looking engineers and technicians on the way. She nodded gravely to each one as she strode past. All of them wished her luck. They were all counting on her to bring the team back safely. She arrived in the locker rooms to find several piles of clothes lying about on the benches. The rest of her team must already be suited up, she thought. She passed a neat pile of clothes next to an open locker and glanced up at the name on the door. It read, "Patricia Harvey." The word Patricia had been crossed out, and Patty written in biro above it. Grace sighed and smiled sadly to herself. It was just like Patty to leave her locker open. She was always so trusting. Grace wiped her eyes on her sleeve and opened the door a little wider. Inside it was neat and well ordered. Grace gave a wry smile as she thought of the chaotic state of her own locker. She was just closing the door when she noticed a glimmer in the darkness. She looked closer and saw that it was a small Saint Christopher, hung on a chain from one of the shelves. Without thinking, she lifted it down and curled up the chain in her palm. She stared at the pendant for a moment, then jumped as a loud klaxon went off outside the room. It was a warning sign indicating 5 minutes before the second beacon was sent. Grace curled her hand around the necklace, then strode off to her own locker, where her environment suit hung. Alex stared absent-mindedly out of the window. The huge derelict warehouse creaked and groaned in the still night. He looked across the dark jumble of shabby roofs which made up the rest of the industrial site. It would be getting light soon, he thought. For a second, the thick clouds parted, allowing a glimmer of moonlight to slip through, illuminating the twisted mass of junk in the scrapyard nearby. A dog barked some way off, and a sudden blast of opera music started up from a distant radio. A light came on in one of the houses on the other side of the rough wasteland near the gas tower. The light went off and the music ceased, leaving an eerie silence. Alex's eye caught a movement in the narrow alley by the side of the scrapyard. He froze. Drago murmured in his sleep, then suddenly opened his eyes and sat upright. He went to speak, then caught the expression on Alex's face. He looked anxiously at his friend. Picking their way carefully through the unlit alley were two dark shadows moving slowly towards the warehouse. Alex strained his eyes to make out the shapes in the dim moonlight. One figure was tall and thin, the other squat and well-built, yet carried himself in a way that was ominously familiar to Alex. The clouds closed again, blocking out the moon, returning the two figures to the shadows. Alex moved slowly back from the window into the half-light of the huge room.
"Is it them?"
hissed Drago in a panic. The sweat on his face glistened in the orange glow of the street lamp. Alex nodded slowly and put his mouth up to Drago's ear.
"It's the man from the airport, with one other. There are probably more elsewhere."
Drago had a sickly pallor. His hand shook badly as he straightened his glasses.
"What do we do, Alexei?"
he squeaked. The sudden clank of a bottle being knocked over on the other side of the building split the air. The two men stiffened, straining their ears for any other sound. There was a faint, muffled thud as someone forced the door downstairs.
"How did they find us?"
whispered Drago, panic-stricken.
"They couldn't have followed me, I'm sure. It must have been you, Alexei."
Alex held a finger up to his lips to silence Drago. He nodded over to the far wall to indicate that they were leaving. Drago nodded frantically and went to pick up his case. Alex placed a firm hand on the man's arm and shook his head. They crept slowly to the far end of the room, picking their way through the rubbish and debris. Alex's heart pounded in his ears. He thought he may have a chance on his own, but Drago was a real handicap. For a second he considered leaving him, then pushed the thought out of his mind. They reached the wall and gingerly made their way through the dark shadows of abandoned furniture. A creak and a muffled curse sounded somewhere below them. They froze, and Alex pulled Drago down into a crouch. Some way off on the far side of the room, they saw the beam of a torch pierce the cracks in the rough floorboards. The light was quickly extinguished, and Alex took a deep breath. They were on the first flight of steps, he thought to himself. They would be in the room in a few seconds. Alex turned to Drago and tried to give him a reassuring smile in the half-light. Drago looked petrified. Still crouching low, they reached the corner of the room and a small doorway. The door was rotten, its glass panes cracked or smashed. Alex carefully pushed it open and crept into the darkness beyond. There was a loud, sickening crunch as Drago followed, clumsily treading on a shard of broken glass. Alex shot him an angry glance and strained to hear anything from the other room. In the distance, the sound of the radio started up again, a crescendo of opera music cutting across the still night.
"We're trapped,"
hissed Drago frantically, surveying the dark room. It had been a small windowless office with a high ceiling that disappeared into the darkness. Now it was abandoned and strewn with rubbish, and all the office furniture was piled up in a precarious tower against the far wall. There was no sign of an exit.
"What are we going to do, Alexei?"
Alex clamped his hand across Drago's mouth, placing his ferocious face up close to the hysterical man.
"Say one word and I'll leave you here, okay?"
he said in a cold, low tone. Drago shut his eyes and nodded wildly. Alex removed his hand from Drago's mouth. He turned and surveyed the pile of furniture. A large filing cabinet on its side on top of a huge office desk. A smaller cabinet sat on top of these, reaching three quarters of the way to the ceiling. It was exactly as he had left it all those years ago, when they had set it up as a safe house. He crept over to the tower of furniture and tested his weight on the rotten table. It felt moderately safe. He clambered lightly up, carefully checking that everything was solid as he went. It was much darker in this room, away from the glow of the street lamp, and Alex had to climb by touch and memory. He stood on top of the cabinet, his body flattened against the damp wall, as the pile of furniture swayed a little. He held his breath. He leant with his cheek pressed against the wet, flaking plaster, dizzy in the darkness. The tower swayed again a little, and he steadied himself with his palms outstretched. Alex heard a faint footstep echo on metal. His heart raced. They were in the next room. It wouldn't be more than a few seconds before they saw the doorway.
"Alexei, hurry!"
hissed Dragol, looking up at him, his pale face glowing in the darkness.
"Shut up,"
thought Alex, slowly reaching his arms upward. He could see the dark square of the missing ceiling tile in the gloom. He carefully stretched up, beads of sweat dripping coldly down his back, and pieces of flaking plaster falling into his mouth and eyes. A barely audible crunch of glass in the other room. They were halfway to the door. Alex stood on tiptoes, reaching for the frame, stretching as much as he dare on the precarious footing. He remembered kicking out the panel all those years ago for just such an eventuality. He was younger then, and more athletic. He didn't know if he'd still have the strength to pull himself up.
"Alexei!"
he heard Dragor's panic-stricken whisper as his fingers walked up the wall towards the opening. Suddenly the cabinet buckled beneath him and swayed violently. Dragor had climbed onto the table. Alex felt the cabinet move from under his feet as Dragor frantically pulled himself upwards. With a slow screech of metal on metal, the cabinet slid away. The door of the one below it sprang open with a crash and its side buckled and toppled off the table. Alex made a desperate grab in the shadows and his fingers found the lip of the opening. He heard Dragor shriek as he tumbled to the floor in the darkness, the cabinets crashing around him. Alex desperately pulled himself up, his legs thrashing to find purchase on the wall. He managed to pull his head up through the hole, then get his elbow onto a joist. He heaved desperately, feeling his knee scrape against a nail protruding from the plaster.
"Alexei, please! Oh God, please, Alexei!"
Dragor's voice was a high-pitched scream. Alex hauled himself through the opening, rolling on his side so that he could look back down. He was gasping and covered with sweat from the exertion, and the pain in his right knee was burning. Dragor's terrified face looked up at him from out of the gloom. The little man was standing desperately on the table, vainly hopping up and down, his hands stretched out imploringly some 3 feet below Alex's reach. Alex stared aghast, then blinked as he caught sight of a faint glow forming around his friend. In the gloom he thought he made out an ephemeral shape, some deformed, humanoid figure, lash out twice in quick succession. It drove its claws into Dragor's body. Two gunshots exploded from the doorway, the flash illuminating the room for an instant, as Alex jumped back in shock. Dragor's knees buckled, and he crumpled instantly, his face swallowed up by the darkness. Alex didn't stop to watch him hit the floor. In an instant he had rolled away from the opening and found the dim square of a moonlight in the blackness. He squeezed through the empty window frame and felt the cold night air chill his sweating face. He sat on the edge of the rotten windowsill and peered into the shadows below. He remembered there being a roof just beneath him, but he couldn't make it out. Perhaps it had collapsed or been pulled down in the intervening years. He heard a slight shuffling below, then an urgent whisper. Alex guessed they had spotted the hole in the ceiling. He took a deep breath and pushed himself off the edge. You have been listening to The Heaven Field. For more information, downloads, and artwork, visit theheavenfield.com.